From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1860, when Susan B. Anthony was becoming more engaged in social activism. Now, you may know that Susan B. Anthony gets quoted by a lot of people for a lot of different reasons, and sometimes those quotes are not accurate. Here's what, at least, I think she said at the time. I'll find out if this is right or wrong. Quote, "Cautious, careful people always casting about to preserve their reputation and social standing never can bring about a reform. Those who are really in earnest must be willing to be anything or nothing in the world's estimation, and publicly and privately, in season and out, avow their sympathy with despised and persecuted ideas and their advocates and bear the consequences," end quote. You don't need me to tell you about the impact that Susan B. Anthony would go on to make in her life. But many people have wondered, what would she say today? What would she say about the political climate? What would she say about the movement toward women's equality, pay equity, so many other questions? What would she say about the presidential campaign? You know, having an idea first requires extensive understanding of Anthony's writing and her own work. The director of the Susan B. Anthony Center at the University of Rochester is making a public presentation titled, If Susan B. Anthony Were Alive Today. Kate Cerulli will include insight based on a review of letters written by Susan B. Anthony and will offer ideas about what kind of advice Susan B. Anthony might give to women on a wide range of issues. Kate is here, one of my guests for the hour on Connections. Nice to have you back here. Kate, how are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Deb Hughes is here, the executive director of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. And Deb, nice to have you.
It's great to be here, Evan.
And Mary Yusong Callen is here, co-president of the League of Women Voters Rochester Metro Area. Where did this idea come from, Mary, to do this kind of a program now?
We present six informational forums to the public every year, and we like to present a broad range of topics. You know, we've looked at grand jury system and the upcoming constitutional convention, and we thought, here in our backyard is Susan B. Anthony, and what do we know about her? Everything that we know is dated, and we thought, here are these topics that probably, were she here today, she would be in the lead on. And so we had spoken with Kate Cerulli recently and watched her do a presentation and thought, she's a natural for us. We would like to make that connection.
Now, the League of Women Voters, needless to say, is a nonpartisan organization. You're not putting together a program like this to try to sort of politically impugn anyone who's got comments one way or another. This is for a historical reflection maybe a stimulating dialogue?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The League is a nonpartisan political organization, but we encourage informed and active participation in government. We work to increase understanding of major public policy issues, and we seek to influence public policy through education and advocacy. This is kind of a natural for us.
You're biased about women's equality, though. You're for it.
We are.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. We've studied the position. We feel that's a
yes.
That's an easy to support
position. Big fans
position.
Of women's equality. So Kate Cerulli, wow, even before I get to the phones, and the phone's already ringing with people who've got questions or comments about what Susan B. would say today. What is the most interesting? What's the question that you would have that maybe you think you know the answer, but if she could be sitting here and talk about one single issue, what would you be most curious to talk about with her, looking at modern issues?
To ask her a question?
Sure. Yeah.
I would ask her how would Susan B. Anthony think that we could make progress in the intersection of all the isms that we're facing today? Because many of them are still the same as issues that she faced. So sexism, racism, homophobia, so many of the things that we know we've made great progress on, but they're still standing in separate silos. And I would want to know, how would she think about bringing those movements together?
Hmm. What about you, Deb?
Yeah, it seems to me that she's so timely for the political discussion that we're having right now, and her whole investment in the idea that we had to be a democracy based in freedom. And to really raise that was an issue throughout her whole lifetime of what does it mean? And even to be a person who says, we'll take the risks of having the crazy people vote because we have to let everybody be a part of democracy. But she also really believed we had an obligation as a society to educate people well so they could approach issues with intelligence and be informed, like what the League of Women Voters does.
Well, I have a small pile of emails from listeners who knew what the program subject was and wanted to weigh in a number of things. A couple essentially just saying, what would she think about Donald Trump? And interestingly, at the Trump rally yesterday, for example, we had a chance to hear from a wide range of supporters, and we heard from a number of people. I've heard from a number of Trump's supporters locally who tell me, I don't like what he says about women, but I know he doesn't really mean that, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of it's for entertainment. A lot of it's for show. And, you know, I don't know if Susan B. were sitting here, if she'd think it's funny or it's acceptable. You know, Kate, do you have a sense for how she would look at the current presidential campaign?
Well, I can tell you from reading over 800 letters. So the project that we're presenting tonight with Mary is a historical look at her own writings. So not interpreting her through the lens of anyone else, but what her letters actually stated. And of course, they have to be taken in context. Susan B. Anthony had a lot of very humorous letters. When we read them, they were tongue-in-cheek and some were quite witty. And we actually thought about titling the program tonight, The Wit and Wisdom of Susan B. Anthony, because she was quite funny at times. But I think what becomes clear from her letters and what Deborah just spoke to is that, you know, she believed in equality and fairness and transparency and everybody having the right to speak and to vote. So I think that she would probably be looking at any presidential election, not just this one, examining the candidates who stand for those tenets of fairness.
That's not a dodge, but can I ask you more forcefully? Would you think she'd be disappointed in some of the rhetoric?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think the rhetoric that surrounds not just this campaign, but we have to be very cautious. This campaign is a reflection of the times in some ways. There was a speaker last Friday at U of R, who the DNC covered it this weekend, who talked about a dip in humanitarianism in some ways right now. We're in a backlash for many issues. So I think that it's not just the campaign that there might be comments towards, but also overall policies and what's happening and trends for a whole bunch of issues.
Deb, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, actually, I'd like Susan B. Anthony to weigh in. I'd love to share a quote from a speech that she made to the Women's Loyal League convention, where this is during the Civil War when they were gathering, and actually they were actually having the discussion, is this war actually about freeing people who are enslaved? What is it about? And they were not in agreement, the women who showed up. And if you'll bear with me this quote, she says, "We talk about returning to the Union as it was and the Constitution as it is, about restoring our country to peace and prosperity, to the blessed conditions which existed before the war, the Civil War. I ask you, what sort of peace, what sort of prosperity have we had since the first slave ship sailed up the James River with its human cargo and there on the soil of the Old Dominion was sold to the highest bidder? We have had nothing but war. When that pirate captain landed on the shores of Africa and there kidnapped the first stalwart Negro and fastened the first manacle, the struggle between that captain and that Negro was the commencement of the terrible war in the midst of which we are today. Between the slave and the masters, there's been war and war only. This is but a new form of it. No, no, we ask for no return to the old conditions. We ask for something better. We want a union which is a union in fact, a union in spirit, not a sham. By the Constitution as it is, the North has pledged to protect slavery in the states where it existed, and we've been bound," and she goes on, but I love that. No, we want a union, a true union, not a sham. But to me, that...
You could see her saying something like that now?
I could see her in a debate with any political person talking about her vision for what she thinks the country should be about.
What do you think, Kate?
Oh, I definitely agree with that. And the letters that we've been reading... I'll tell you, Evan, sometimes I sit and review letters, and we've read them all over, New York City, Washington, D.C., the Library of Congress. I sit there and read them, and it's almost as though she's sitting in the room talking to us today. And I was reading some of the letters in Washington, D.C. during the highlight of the police brutality and what was happening throughout the country with deaths of young people, both armed and unarmed individuals. And I have a brief quote that will really speak to that exact issue, what we were facing and still are, where she speaks to the failings of social equality in the U.S. And this is one of her letters from 1900. She says, "The same is true of men who are content to hold women in political serfdom, are incapable of giving justice to their own sex. The cruelty of women's enslavement is cropping out on all sides. And yet no one scarcely sees that the or of seeing proposes to begin at the taproot of the disease, culminating in the general desecration of human rights in bloodshed and murder and in lynchings and outrages upon men and women of all races. We are in a fearful transition now, and I hope somehow our men and women will soon be able to discover the cause of all the barbarics.
End quote.
You could have said that this summer. You could have said that right now.
Well, before I jump to your phone calls, and we do have a lot to discuss this hour, we'll do that in just a second. I want Mary just to remind us what's coming up tonight. It is at 7 p.m. at Asbury First United Methodist Church. Some of the details, Mary?
It is. Catherine will be presenting tonight, and we've asked her to speak to What If Susan B. Anthony Were Alive Today? And it's a free-form discussion on her part. We're inviting her to just bring things that she knows about Susan B., bring them up to our time today and enlighten us all. We tend to know Susan in her time. We'd like to know her better in ours.
Free to the public.
Free to the public. Asbury First Methodist Church, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock tonight. And lastly, before I get to the phone calls, Kate, I've got to think, you know, I have to think you take this very seriously. When you've got to make a public presentation, what might Susan B. Anthony say today? That's a lot of weight on your shoulders to have someone of that historical significance and trying to interpret what they may make of, you know, the current landscape.
But I think what Deborah just spoke to is that I can let Susan B. Anthony speak for herself. I mean, I don't think there's an issue that I have worked on as an attorney, an advocate, a professor that the letters don't speak to. And the students who have been working with me, Becca and Sarah, remark constantly how amazing this project has been because the letters are alive. They are so real with issues that we're facing today still.
All right, we're going to be talking about that letters project coming up here too. There's also kind of a Twitter project as well. There's a lot to talk about, but let me grab a couple phone calls. Folks have been waiting to join the conversation. Carol in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi, Evan, and hello to Deborah and Kate. Yeah, I'm president of the Susan B. Anthony Birthplace in Adams, Massachusetts. And one of the things that Deborah and I tried to do as part of our institutions dealing with history is to primarily stick to the facts, even when trying to answer questions like the topic of this show. Susan B. Anthony's newspaper, The Revolution, has over 100 references to abortion, and unanimously the suffragists opposed abortion. The paper, Susan's paper, actually refused to run ads for abortion like other newspapers of the day did. And this policy was explicitly, in very definitive language, defended that policy over 23 times by the editors of that newspaper, one of whom was Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And the House in the spring of 2013 invited Dr. Allison Parker, a women's historian from SUNY Brockport, to talk about this topic, and she unequivocally agreed that they all opposed abortion. And I wondered if you would comment on that.
Carol, thanks for the phone call. Let me also, and follow up to Carol's phone call, let me go ahead and read an email I got that kind of dovetails with this, and then we'll let our panel respond here. An email from a listener named Annette writes, the following, quote, pro-abortion feminists tend to insist that equality means there are no differences between men and women. Susan B. Anthony was a proud, strong woman, but she understood that there are differences, and I would think that she was careful to make sure women didn't become too much like men. That's why I tend to believe she was, in fact, pro-life, and would be proud to be pro-life in today's political climate. That's from Annette. So you heard Carol's comments, you heard Annette, and I know this is hardly the first time this question's come up. So Deb Hughes, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Well, hi, Carol. Our interpretation of what's included in the Revolution is a different interpretation. There were many things that were published in the Revolution that the editors disagreed with. In fact, they allowed that format and had that. And some of the quotes that we've talked about a couple times on the show already actually pull out of context. In particular, there's one editorial that actually is opposed to the criminalization of abortion that's used to demonstrate the opposite. What we know about Susan B. Anthony, she didn't ever take a public stand on the issue. She was silent on the issue. She was very loud on the issue of believing that children should have sex education, that women should be able to time the frequency and the space between their pregnancies. She supported birth control. She was very clear about that. We also know that Susan B. Anthony did believe that a woman should have financial freedom and freedom over her body. But the reason that we keep having this conversation is she never made a statement directly for the criminalization of abortion or related to that.
I think organizations like, for example, Feminists for Life, who quote Susan B. Anthony often, and again, you guys are the authorities on the quotation, certainly not me. I think what they may say is, you know, you've said, well, we can look to her quotes, her own words, her letters, to help inform what she might say today. And they're just trying to do the same thing. Here's an example. They used the following quotation on some various mailers and websites. Feminists for Life used this quote. Quote, sweeter even than to have had the joy of caring for children of my own has it been to me to help bring about a better state of things for mothers generally so their unborn little ones could not be willed away from them. End quote.
Yes. So here's the shocking truth behind that. We, in today's framework, think, oh, that's talking about a child who's been conceived, a fetus, who has not yet been born. But the truth of the matter is it actually goes way beyond that. In Susan B. Anthony's time in the 19th century, if you were the man, you owned the children your spouse had, those who were conceived, born, and those who had not yet been conceived. A man could will away the unborn children that had not even been conceived yet. And that's what Susan B. Anthony is making reference to, definitely. In that statement. That was very common practice. It was one of the reasons she used it in her speeches in relation to temperance for years, that it was so appalling that a woman even couldn't control the children that were not yet conceived.
Are there misquotes that are occasionally used in the conversation about abortion?
Yes.
Yes?
The biggest one, there's a great bumper sticker. If only Susan B. Anthony had sound bites for some things that we could use, which is, I abhor the crime of child murder. That's from an editorial that appears in the Revolution magazine. It's signed initial A. We have some very good evidence. In fact, we're going to be publishing an article in the next couple of weeks on our website that a local author's done a wonderful analysis that most of the editorials that were published in the paper that were signed by initials were particular people. Many of them were men. It was not Susan B. Anthony or Elizabeth Cady Stanton. But if you actually read the context of that, it says, though I abhor the crime of child murder, and it goes on to say, we can't criminalize abortion, I'm paraphrasing that, because, and it does say this, it cuts off the head but ignores the noxious root. And basically that editorial says, before we even say that a woman can't have an abortion, we should be looking at all the reasons and all the social crises that cause her to think of doing that. And even at that time, one of the great crimes was that women were being forced to have abortions by their spouses.
Okay, so Kate Cerulli, when you talk about Susan B. Anthony, how often does someone ask you, flat out, did she take a position on abortion or didn't she think this or that? How often does that come up?
I get asked that probably every time I speak, and I can tell
every time.
You, yeah, pretty much when we speak publicly. And I can tell you that our group was very open in our coding process. So we had a grid which we worked on, and the topics ranged from children to voting, the status of women, elderly parents, health, death, wealth, leaning in, leaning out, friendship, you know, image of women and religion overall. Those codes were what we read when we were reading the letters, and we would fill in these quotes and grids. We also had secondary reviewers, so one person wasn't left up to their own impression. And in the letters that I've read and I've reviewed, and I've looked at a lot of them out of the 800, obviously, I didn't have anything come up in those particular letters that were referenced to abortion specifically.
So if people ask you, do we know or do you think she would have been one way? I mean, how do you typically answer that question?
I think based on the things that Deborah was speaking to, her belief that women had a choice for every aspect of their lives and should have the freedom to choose, I believe that she probably would be pro-choice.
You believe she would be pro-choice?
There's nothing I've seen in the works that I've looked at that doesn't. I defer to Deborah on the Revolution and to Carol on their read of those. I haven't read those newspapers, but the letters specifically have made no reference.
Her own letters. Mm-hmm. And do you think it's possible she would have been pro-life? Or do you think at this point, do we think we don't have enough information to ever say that she was definitively pro-life?
Well, here's the problem I have. I mean, we use the term pro-life as though we all agree what that means. And if you go to the Susan B. Anthony List website, they have a definition of pro-life that says you have to agree to four specific political things. The second one has to do with not agreeing that you won't support the appointment of any judges who have not taken a position against abortion. And the fourth is that you will end all funding for Planned Parenthood in all cases. I know a lot of people who are very comfortable describing their humanitarian heart as pro-life, who would be shocked to find that that would align them with this particular pledge. So I really just wish we would not even use that phrase. I think we should talk specifically about what we talk about. You know, often one of the great things that I respect in Carol is tremendous consistency in her ethic, protesting for years against the death penalty. I know many people whose position in regard to abortion is very different from their position in regard to capital punishment.
Or war.
Or self-defense, all kinds of issues. And, you know, how can we support a stand-your-ground law for men to shoot another human being, but say at the same time that we are, quote, pro-life? I think that we're using those phrases as though they have meaning and we understand it, and I think it's really confusing and we ought to really be much more specific about what we mean.
All right, I think we've said enough on the issue, though, because it comes up, as Kate said, every time. It'll probably come up tonight, among many others, but there's so much more out there. Let me grab another phone call on, I think, a different subject. John in Webster, next up. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. Thank you. It's a great show.
Thanks.
I think Susan Leontay would be delighted that women have come as much as they have, but she would think that it's not enough. And she would decry the fact that contraception is not available in some areas and that some legislatures or governors are trying to stop contraception. I think it would also be degrading for people to talk about Susan B. Anthony as pro-life, because we really don't know one way or the other. But I lean to what one of your commentators said, that she was not pro-life. And at that time in America, if you were to read the oath of the Salvation Army, yes, the Salvation Army, you would be absolutely stunned by what it says about women and children. I think she would be really surprised that a church could instill in its members the need to become activists against the Equal Rights Amendment and spend millions of dollars, as a prominent church in Utah did, to make sure that the Equal Rights Amendment never gained enough votes by the states. And I think she would be very upset at the way women are used in our politics today. It's as though they're something out there, but we don't notice them at all until politics comes around, and then they are wooed for their votes. And as a philosopher, I think she would be really amazed at the state of American philosophy today, that philosophers don't come out as activists in support of women's rights and the rights to have an abortion. I'll take any comments off the air.
John, thanks for the phone call. Kate Cerulli, I'll start with you. What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to stop thinking that the word woman is a conceptualization of one thing. There's great heterogeneity in women. We have younger women. We have the millennials. We have women in their middle years. We have women in their later years. We have women of all kinds of races and ethnicities. And I think that we are individuals. And to have politics focus largely on our uterus is concerning to me. There are so many issues that are tied to contraception. When we think about the broader discussions we need to be having right now, pay equity, we need to be talking about subsidized childcare. We have one of the worst track records for that in all industrialized nations. We have one of the highest infant mortality rates currently in Rochester, worse than our third world city sisters. I think that we have to broaden this discussion to look at the incredible diversity in the United States populations and how candidates are going to meet the needs of individuals, regardless of their gender, their race, and all the other isms that we mentioned earlier. So I think the dialogue has to be deeper. I think it has to be richer and more inclusive.
An email from a listener named Allison says, you don't need to tiptoe around what Susan B. Anthony might say about the presidential candidates today. And she sends me a link to a quote that I don't think I had read before. It comes from a book called The Art of the Comeback by Donald Trump. And this is the quote. He talks about how women, working moms, are particularly lacking in loyalty and do not make for very good employees. Quote, she's not giving me 100%. She's giving me 84%, and 16% is going towards taking care of children. End quote. And so Allison emails the program to say, we don't have to pretend what Susan B. Anthony would think about that. Anybody disagree with that? Deb Hughes?
I jump on another quote, again, from her speech to the Women's Lawyer League. Women must now assume her God-given responsibilities and make herself what she's clearly designed to be, the educator of the race. Let her no longer be the mere reflection, the echo of the worldly pride and ambition of man. She goes on a little bit later to say to women that forget conventionalisms. Forget what the world will say, whether you're in your place or out of it. Think your best thoughts. Speak your best words. Do your best works, looking to your own conscience for approval.
Okay. Kate Cerulli, what do you think about Allison's email?
Well, I think it's so interesting because about this whole working mother working issue when people reflect on that and think about it. And I just want to share with you a very great conversation I had with a young man. He is in college. I believe he was a junior at the time. And we were talking about getting married and gender stereotypes in relationships, marriage, and childcare. And he was speaking to wanting to have his wife stay at home. And he was raised in a double working family. And when I asked this young man, well, tell me about that, he said, well, I think it's really important. I've decided I want to have a mom at home. And I said to him, well, let's take your example. This young man was an engineering major, and his girlfriend at the time was going to be a doctor. And we talked about comparative salaries. And I said, are you curious about a mother staying home, or are you curious about a parent staying home? And would you consider staying home? And his eyes lit up. It was this aha moment for him. And we started this discussion with other kids on college campuses around BEAM's gender schema and how we perceive ourselves and our limitations and possibilities based on the environments that we come from and the messages that we receive. So I think equality for women is equality for everybody, because as women make progress in the workplace and have fair pay and access, it allows their partners, male or female, to be able to do what they choose to do and really to follow their heart. And that's why I think this gender dichotomy has to go away a little bit. And this notion of a mother working is intriguing to me, because most fathers work. In fact, the large majority of men who work do not take advantage of either parental leave or actually stay home to raise their children. So I think that her comment is interesting, that if we want to talk about working parents, I know plenty of men who are juggling childcare, pickup, drop-off, and very harried schedules. So I think that that's an equal opportunity issue.
I've got a four-year-old. I don't think anybody has ever questioned my loyalty to WXXI when on an afternoon where I've got to get home and pick him up, or my wife's working and I've got, you know, it's a bit tighter, and so I'll go grab him. I get out the office. I've got a wonderfully supportive environment here. They also know that anyone who works for Connections works very, very hard. But it is a supportive environment that says, you know, you need to get out the door to pick him up. You're going to go. And I've never been questioned about that. And I, being the dad, you know, I've never been in the position to understand what that's like to be a woman who's questioned for loyalty. So I will just say this. Allison, thank you for the email. And maybe Marielle, our intern, Megan Mack, producer, can help just verify. I hadn't seen that Trump quote before, so I typically try not to read too many quotes unless I know for a fact. Did he really say that a woman's only going to be 84% loyal to him if she is working and has a child, and therefore they're not all the working moms are not great employees? I don't know if Trump actually said that. And so We'll try to verify that before the end of the hour. Let's do this. Let's get a short break. We're going to come back. We'll remind you why we're here, because there's an event tonight, and we'll tell you about that. And then got an email about voting rights acts and what Susan B. Anthony might think about voter ID laws and things like that that limit opportunity for some Americans to vote, men and women, particularly people of color. Emailer wanted to know what Kate Cerulli thinks Susan B. Anthony might say about that today, among many other things. So let's get a short break and continue the conversation next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the Next Connections first hour, a look at the state of foster care. And then in our second hour, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders supporters join us. We'll have a conversation about the state of the Democratic race. Later this week, we'll talk Republicans, but on Tuesday, second hour, it's the Democrats, and we've seen a lot of political activity. What's going to happen on primary day in New York State? Join the conversation Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Producer Megan Max, nice enough to help verify that quote. It was a Donald Trump quote. And I think what we've established is if Susan B. Anthony were alive today, it's unlikely she would have been waving a Trump sign yesterday, just based on the historical evidence. But, and I know a lot of our listeners have emailed questions and comments about Trump, the current campaign. But there is so much more, I think, to Susan B. Anthony and her life and her work. And that's what Kate Cerulli is going to be focusing on tonight, among many other issues, not the least of which Emma sends an email, a long email about the Voting Rights Act and voter ID laws, and wonders what Kate thinks Susan B. Anthony might think if she were alive today about some of these ostensible efforts that would limit opportunity for people to vote. Kate, what do you think?
Well, I think that's getting back to what was said earlier today, and I completely concur with Deborah that I think that Susan B. Anthony believed in equality and in voting for everyone. And the systems that we use and misuse to allow people to vote are obviously concerning. When, you know, I think about my own family history, my grandmother and grandfather coming from Italy, we had great-grandparents who came from Ireland, people who worked hard. They either, you know, rented, eventually some of them owned their own homes. But I think that I would never want someone who is a hard worker, doing well, living here and contributing to society to ever have their question of that right to vote taken away from them. And you know, I tell my children and the students that I'm teaching at the University of Rochester, my heart breaks when I read newspaper accounts of international voting days where people are losing their life standing in line. You know, in this country, we had one of the primaries. People were in line for hours. That shows you the visceral need and desire for people to want to vote and have a voice in who their leaders are.
Even though, in some ways, we've done very little to make it easier. And I think we've talked with the League in the past, Mary, about everything from early voting to should we still be voting on Tuesdays? Well, what was the agrarian reason for that? And voting with technology, all the different things that probably could change to make it easier that haven't really happened. We've kind of talked about with the League in the past. I suspect maybe Susan B. Anthony would be at least wondering why, you know, she'd probably be amazed at what an iPhone is. Who wouldn't if they were born in the 1800s? But we're not really using technology in many ways for voting, Mary.
We're not. The League strongly supports making access to voting easier, whether it's extending voting to early voting, as many states have done. You know, Oregon now has automatic registration to vote where you have to opt out. And in fact, I just saw some information from Pew that that seems to be increasing turnout. I mean, that those are wonderful things. The League strongly supports those things. And you have to think that we're an outgrowth of, you know, one of our foremothers. We're founded by Carrie Chapman Catt, who was one of the women who followed Susan B. We have to assume that those are goals that they had, and hopefully they're goals that we'll see realized. We're certainly in that fight.
Well, remind our listeners before we hit some other subjects, what's going on tonight, Mary?
Tonight we'll invite Catherine Cerulli to come and bring Susan B. Anthony to life for us beyond just the facts of her life. Give us insights on who she was and how she might look at the struggles that we're in, what she might have supported, that we're doing, what insights she might offer to us in our in our efforts.
And Kate has read so many letters that you get a sense for who Susan B. Anthony is well beyond even some of the obvious political signposts that we all know from her life. And what's interesting is there's a Sue B. Says project on Twitter launched in last August from the account at @UofR_SBAC. Or you can check out the hashtag Sue B. Says, Susan B. Anthony Center, tweeting twice a week on topics such as health, relationships, education, race, mentoring, family, voting, and more. Material pulled from Susan B. Anthony's letters, which are archived at Rochester's University of Rochester's Rush Reese Library, the Monroe County Library System, the New York Public Library, and the Library of Congress. It's a rich portrait of her that you're kind of giving us there, aren't you, Kate?
Yeah, I think one of the things I need to say, the Sue B. Says hashtag was one of our students' ideas, Alicia, and it is really the students that are bringing life to this project, their creative energy. John Cullen, my colleague, and the students are working very hard on the Twitter project, and the way that they're tying it to other hashtags to get viewers to look at things Sue B. said who maybe wouldn't have in the past. And one of the biggest hits we got was the day John Cullen connected it to the Powerball, and sort of implying if Sue B. had bought a ticket or won the lottery, we would have been in a different place today as women, perhaps. But that had so many views. And, you know, I think to try to use social media as a tool for education and a tool for social change is wonderful. I think it's been used equally as a weapon against equal rights and a weapon against equality. So I think for those of us who are doing educational work, especially trying to reach younger generations, tweeting is an effective way to do that. And there's actually a group at U of R led by the data science managers. I'm working with my colleague, Dr. White, and she's actually looking at Twitter downloads and looking at trends. And one of her students just did an amazing presentation in the face of the Ray Rice, which I was here talking with you about, hashtag why I stayed or why she stays, analyzing that data to try to learn from it. So using Twitter as an educational vehicle both ways, learning from the data that comes in and the data that we put out.
What else are you going to talk about tonight? We got so much you could choose from.
What I'm trying to do this evening is touch upon every coding category that we had, which you just mentioned. So tying it to women's self-images. If you look at anorexia and bulimia today and the way that women view themselves and the pressure that women had back in Sue B.'s time, not only the way they dressed and the restricted clothing that they had and how women's attire was such a focal point, but Susan B. Anthony struggling in some of the letters with her own appearance and feeling quite self-conscious of that. And the way that we portray her today, you often look at images of her and they're very hard and seem very, but you know, there are some beautiful photos of Susan B. Anthony, and the house has a number of those. So, you know, how is it that 100 years later, we are still using women's bodies in misogynistic ways to sell products? And when we look at, in particular, the fashion industry, we see horrible images of women with mock rapes. And there's one fashion industry right now that has an image of a woman who is, it looks like a gang rape is about to happen, and it's to sell a pair of shoes. I mean, when we look at that and ask ourselves, why is that allowed? And how do we as women utilize our power, which would be being consumers? You know, women purchase products. Do we know where our products are coming from and whether they're being made by children who are being slave labor or people who are being paid a fair wage in their own country? So those are the sort of issues we're going to be talking about as each category that we coded. Clearly, we can't do 800 letters in coding in an hour, but we'll be touching upon some of the highlights.
You know, we touched briefly last week after a listener had brought up the idea of Kim Kardashian putting out photos of herself half naked, saying, I'm a proud feminist, I own my body, you know, sort of strong sexuality. And there was some interesting pushback from some listeners and various guests on this program about, well, is that the kind of feminism? Is that really feminism? Objectifying women versus strong sexuality? And I am curious about how Susan B. Anthony would think about, you're right, some of the body image issues that young people can have, some of the expectations, the over-sexualization that can happen in various ways, you know, sort of contrasting that with a desire to let women be strong and, you know, sort of finding sexual equality. So I don't know how much in her letters or your work speaks to that. But like you say, 100 years later, she may be surprised at what she finds in various ways.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. I mean, I think when you look at the question of feminism, as I said earlier, that means different things to different women and different men. And when we interviewed 190 people on what does feminism mean to you today, across the lifespan, we had from 18 to 90-year-olds, men and women. And feminism means very different things to different people. And I think sexual freedom and autonomy for one's body and self and choices and partners is quite different than exploitation. And using exploitation, especially with images of violence, to sell products. And I think that they are two different things that often get confused. You may have different opinions, Deborah, about Susan B.'s thoughts, but you know, we certainly didn't have the imagery then that we have now.
Sure.
Well, you know, even when she was in her late teens, at one point she breaks out of the Quaker dress and she's wearing this plaid dress, and she writes home to say that she's been noticed. And her uncle, who was a brilliant businessman early on, said, "You'll go farther if you get noticed." And so she understood that pragmatic approach. She advised Kate Gleason to dress more in a more interesting and more fashionable way. And Kate later said that was one of the great things that helped her to succeed and to sell machines in Europe. But she would ask the question of, is what you're doing actually getting the response that you want? So for Kim Kardashian, yeah. So are people picking up those cards and saying, wow, this is a bright, intelligent woman who knows what she's doing? And I think that's where the question is, what are you really projecting and how is it being used? And there are very few images that are sexualized, over-sexualized, that aren't used actually to diminish and disrespect a woman.
Here is an email from Alan in Pittsford. And he writes, "I would like to think that she would be amused by the national debate about bathroom access." I am sure he's referring to the question on transgender bathroom and restroom availability. I don't know, amused is what I would expect Susan B. Anthony to be, but I don't know. So Alan is saying he would like to think she'd be amused by that. Deb?
She dealt with gender bias directly. In Rochester, it was illegal to dress as the other sex. You could go to jail for that.
It was illegal?
It was illegal. It was in the city. It's one of the few things you can read a law in the city directory in the 1870s. And one of the ways that they discredited Susan B. Anthony was to say that she was a mannish woman, or even to say that she wasn't a woman. You know, she couldn't get a husband. That was a great way. That wasn't just a joke. I mean, it was to discredit her for that very purpose, to suggest that she was actually socially immoral and she was corrupting people by her by being someone who was so out of the role for a woman of her time. She turned it around and said she envisioned a time when there would be feminine men and masculine women, and that everyone could bring their own skills and their own abilities to every situation, where we would resolve things completely differently, to break out of that binary gender, although she didn't use those terms. So the questions about gender and role were very present in the 19th century. They were dealing with it all the time. And that's one of the things that Susan B. Anthony pretty consistently felt that people should be received for the human being that they are.
Kate, any thoughts on whether she would be amused at this conversation about transgender bathrooms?
I don't think that she'd be amused. I think she'd ask, why did it take so long? I mean, as a woman who's waited in line in a lot of lady room lines, you know, I'm delighted that rooms will be gender inclusive, and not to mention people who face discrimination and harassment depending on which bathroom they enter at any given moment. U of R is working very hard to have gender neutral locations throughout the River campus and the medical campus. There's a diversity and inclusion committee that's been working on that with a strong alumni advocate. I think it's important, and I think that the amusement might come from what took so long.
We'll be talking to Scott Fearing a week from today on this program about some of the developments, some of the laws that have passed recently, not the least of which is in North Carolina on the state level about things like that. So we will revisit that subject as well. I also want to ask Kate, if you could, just to kind of tell us a little bit more about, well, the letters themselves. I get fascinated with old letters, particularly because we don't write letters anymore as a society. And the question of analyzing the letters and understanding, or at least reading, Where are they? They're at Rush Rees, their Monroe County Library System, and you know, how are they sort of organized?
The letters are actually all over. So there is a series of the letters that are available to everybody. They're online and they're web access, easily read. There are certain letters that are paper copy only, and then there are letters which have actually been transcribed. So they've been typed word for easier reading. The letters we've read include collections from the Library of Congress, the Monroe County Public Library System, the library at the University of Rochester, a series of letters, and we had just purchased another 100 last summer, the Avery Collection, which you did a show on. But what's been interesting is letters coming to us. So we recently got letters from a very small, tiny library that heard about our project through Twitter and sent us copies of the letters they had, which wouldn't have been digitally available. We just got notice from the University of Wisconsin that actually has letters that aren't digitally available, and we're going to be going there to try to read them. And there are letters that surface all the time. When we went to the Library of Congress, our students spent quite a bit of time there. When I got there, I was literally on my last day with 15 minutes left. They lock the library, and they kind of kick you out, and they ring a bell. And I came back and shared with Deborah. It was the most amazing thing. This man came up to me and put this notebook in front of me and said, by the way, these are the things we have that you might not know about. And when I opened the binder, it was old-fashioned, typed on a typewriter, indexes of different things they had that haven't been digitized yet. And that includes her journals, her diaries, some original writings by her.
What was that moment like for you?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. And for us, the journals would fall outside the letters category. The issue will be whether we decide to go back and read the journals to supplement what we've learned in the letters. And you never want to stop a project too soon, but you never want to stop it too late either. And we actually had intended to wrap up our coding at the end of last year, and we protracted it 1 year further. I'm glad that we did, because these letters have been insightful. So the project just continues to grow, and I'm hoping that it creates other projects. Deborah and I have been talking about, once we're done coding, doing some articles to everyday women's magazines, because I think it's important not to have it in academic journals and have it on open access, what every woman might read sitting waiting, you know, for an appointment. We also want to potentially create a documentary where we have famous women read excerpts of the letters, and then as they're reading a letter from Susan B. Anthony's time, have intermittent facts get posted about women's issues today to show the relevance of the letters and try to do something along those lines.
Mm. Remind me, was her handwriting legible, pretty legible? No. Deb, no.
No, you get used to it. And sometimes we, in some of the letters that are transcribed, you know, there's a place where the people who've been working with the letters the longest don't agree about a particular word, and the intent hinges on what you decide. But she, in her later years, most of her letters were dictated, and so they're typewritten, and then she adds more personal notes to them, and that helps a lot when she was so prolific in the last, particularly last 20 years of her life.
I think for me, the ease in reading them is her handwriting, quite remarkably, is very much like my mother's. My mom is 79, and when I first started reading them, I couldn't believe how similar their handwriting was, and it's largely probably because of the schooling people received up until most recently. My biggest concern with this project is the lack of kids being able to read cursive. My kids were probably the first cohort. I have a freshman in college. They really can't read cursive nor write it. And these young women that are in college right now that are part of this project do know how to read cursive. And my worry is what's going to happen with the future of these historical projects when we have stopped teaching our children cursive. And that's largely because of the digital age.
All right, well, we've got down to our last 2 minutes here. So what do you think, Kate, would be the most important? I mean, Susan B. Anthony dedicated her life to suffrage, but a number of other issues as well. If she were alive today, what would be the first thing she'd be signing up to do, you think, in terms of advocating, causes, et cetera? What would you suspect would be top of mind for her in 2016?
I think it would be the same. I would think women's rights and women's equality, and there's still so much to go. And probably mentoring, having young people coming up in the movement to take on the cause.
What do you think, Deb?
Voting rights. She said it was the fundamental principle of democracy. And before our government can be placed on a lasting foundation, the civil and political rights of every citizen must be practically established.
All right, Mary. Tonight, 7 o'clock. The details. Go ahead.
Asbury First Methodist Church on East Avenue in Rochester. Kate will be discussing what Susan B. Anthony would be in favor of, what she'd be supportive of, what she'd be urging us to do if she were alive today.
And quoting from those letters, right? Is that you said, Kate?
Yes, and it's not me speaking for her, hopefully. It's her speaking for herself through her letters, yeah.
Well, there's a treasure trove of that out there. And let me close the hour with just this question, because you've read so many letters, and I know, you know, you get used to it, but is there still anything almost, I don't know, spiritual is the wrong word, but I mean, reading her words, seeing those kind of documents, does that have an impact on you, Kate?
Oh, yes. And I've shared with Deborah, there are times when I read a letter in a particular day or moment. My parents are both aging, so clearly we're dealing with aging parents. And seeing her talk about her parents and her relationships with seniors in her life has been particularly moving.
So much out there that you might not even know exists, and you'll learn a lot from Kate tonight, 7 o'clock at Asbury. Thanks very much for being here. Kate's really nice to see you again in studio. Thanks for taking the time for us here.
Thank you.
Deb Hughes, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Evan. Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Mary from the League of Women Voters Rochester Metro Area. Another great panel tonight, and have a great forum. Thanks for taking the time to preview it with us here.
Thank you, Evan.
Thanks for all the interaction with our listeners today. Our thanks to Marielle Brinkerhoff, intern extraordinaire, and Val LaBanca is the engineer of this broadcast. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Our thanks to you for listening to member-supported public radio.